Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're going to have a conversation here this hour with our three guests, Dante Wilson, who's director of Reclaiming Our Children and Community Project here in Baltimore, Maryland, David Thurston, who is a board member of the Washington Peace Center, who came to Baltimore last night to speak at Red Emma's on capitalism and mental health, which is how we discovered him, at least how we discovered him and his work, and asked him to join this panel. Lauren Abramson joins us by phone, and she is executive director of the Community Conferencing Center, and has been a guest on the show many times as well. And all three, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Lauren, you there? Do we have Lauren on the phone? Can we pot her up? Hi, Lauren. Okay, well, let's get her on the phone. We'll get Lauren Abrams on the phone here in just a minute. One of the things that's inspired this show to come on the air today was what happened yesterday, but what happened last week and that we talked about yesterday, which was the incident at the McDonald's when a young transgender woman was beaten pretty savagely by two other young women, both of whom were teenagers, both of whom had a history of violence in their lives. We thought a lot about what happens in those situations and what should our response be. I mean, immediate response is we heard a lot of people saying these two young girls who did this beating should be buried under the jail, should be put in prison, should be treated the way they treated this young person. And they're both actually now inside jail waiting trial because our bail system's so high they can't afford bail, but they're in jail. Maybe these two women should be separated from society because of their violence, and maybe they should. That's something to be explored. They both have a history of violence in their lives. One of the things I posited was, is there another way to address this? Or another way to address this in the sense that how can you address this violent crime, and it is a violent crime, well, other than incarceration? Or is incarceration the answer to this problem and separating violent individuals from the rest of us? Or is there another way to begin to think about how to address this problem? And later in the program, we'll explore why we have so much violence in society, in our society, where it comes from, and what we do about it. So, I mean, what would be your responses to what happens to these young women? Dante?
My response to the situation is that we need a systemic intervention. And when I say systemic intervention, sending the young ladies to jail, in my opinion, it's not going to rehabilitate the young girls. I think the young girls acted out of emotions. These emotions were fostered by the molded culture or subculture that they have assimilated to. And so in order to truly rehabilitate these young girls and make the situation have a positive outlook, we have to intervene in that manner. And so that may include some other things such as family strengthening, some things that we might not have control over, such as the media and how the media presents certain things to society. And we have so many young, inspiring minds that mimic what these perceptions and media portray them to be. And so I think we could discuss some ideas. However, it's a larger picture that we have to address if we want true rehabilitation and interventions to take place.
I agree with that. I think that you really need a multifaceted approach to these sorts of situations. I think that this is a hate crime, and those responsible should be held accountable for their actions. But there is very, very little in the way of genuine rehabilitation that is currently part of our criminal justice system. People who commit crimes are incarcerated for years, are denied educational opportunities, mm-hmm. are denied access to family, are denied access to support systems. In prison, very often what takes place is that people are warehoused in extraordinarily violent circumstances. And, you know, I've had encounters with the criminal justice system myself, being someone with mental health issues who is often in an episode run afoul of a police officer for whatever reason. And what I observed in jail myself is that the vast majority of conversations that go on between inmates are not about how to transform their lives, but are about how to get back out on the streets and do what they were doing without getting caught. You know, so what I guess what I'm trying to say is that this is a window into a very, very serious and systemic problem. I would be in favor of these women, you know, facing charges, but being provided with counseling, being, I mean, there are anger management issues here. There are cultural and social sensitivity issues here. And to me, you have to ask why transgender people in our society do not have equal rights. You know, I mean, the blame cannot be solely placed on the shoulders of these two women. We have to look at the institutions that continue to oppress people who do not meet gender norms.
And I think Lauren's with us. Lauren Abramson, you there?
I'm here. Glad to be here. Thanks.
How are you?
Doing well. How you doing?
I'm good. Good to have you on the air with us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So talk about this. I know you knew about this in the beginning. You saw this like the rest of us did, and I'm curious what your response is, what our response should be, our being our society's response.
Well, I mean, as you know, and I don't know to what extent your listeners know, for 13 years we've been providing an alternative to court called community conferencing, where we bring together those who've caused the harm, those who've been harmed, and their respective supporters, and give them a chance to hear what happened, and everybody gets a chance really to say on an emotional level how they were affected by what happened, and then the group collectively gets a chance to decide how to make it better and prevent it from happening again and repair any harm. So as serious as this is, I mean, we have done so many or handled so many hate incidents within the school system and in the city, and, you know, just find that it's so powerful when we give people a chance to actually talk to each other in the wake of something like this. Like I've heard some of, you know, the folks say just before me, I mean, there's a lot that people don't understand about other groups, and we label other groups without really understanding who people are. And it is just, I think the true transformation in how people behave and how they think about people happens when they actually meet real people and get a chance to talk to them. So, I mean, I think it would be incredibly powerful to have a community conference around what happened. We are able to get referrals for some felony offenses, but my guess is that it would be tough for us to get referral for a case like this.
And I want to open the phones early. A lot of people are calling in and have very many different ideas about this. And I want to explore the nature of violence, but why people are made so violent in our society, why they become so violent in our society, and what our response needs to be. I mean, Lauren just talked about the difficulty about the work they do in community conferencing, which is something that has worked very powerfully around the country. They don't use it enough in our own backyard where it is the center exists. Lauren, before we go to Keith and Yvette, our first two callers, and Hank and Elle, our first four callers up, and an email here from Katie, which I'll read. I wish you would just take just a few minutes and describe for our listeners what community conferencing is and what it does and how it works, so people understand what you're referring to.
Well, so we get cases diverted from the court system, and basically we're saying to the community of people that are affected by an incident. So it's everybody who's been involved in causing harm, everybody who has been harmed, and their respective supporters, we're saying that we're empowering you to understand have a chance to be accountable for the harm that was done, and a chance to heal from this and learn how to move forward so that it doesn't happen again. And I got to say, we've handled over 900 cases in Baltimore City. 98% of the time that people come together, victims and offenders and their families, in a community conference, they've been able to come up with a written agreement about how to repair the harm and how to prevent it from happening again. And there has been 95% compliance with those agreements that people come up with. And there's 60% lower reoffending. for the young people who have caused harm who go through community counseling.
And describe what you mean by causing harm, then I will open the phones.
Okay, so it could be anything from bullying at school to fighting to being arrested for auto theft, breaking and entering, shoplifting, second-degree assault. We get all sorts of cases diverted to us.
Let me open the phones here. We're talking about the incident that occurred, but in the larger sense, we're talking about what these things mean for ourselves in the society we live in, this community we live in, and how do we respond to it. Many people always complain there are too many people in jail as it is. And as I say often, we have more people in jail in the United States of America than we do in any other country on the planet Earth in terms of our percentage of population. Let's go to the phones. 410-319-8888. Keith, you're on the air. Welcome.
Well, first I'd like to say, from what I understand about the 18-year-old young lady, she was arrested for the same thing last year.
Right.
In Baltimore. At the same, matter of fact, at the same McDonald's. What I'm going to ask you, your panelists over there, is how many bites of the apple should she have now? What kind of systemic intervention can you have for her if she just an assault of somebody? The only reason why she's not in jail now is because the people refused it. They didn't want to. They didn't really want to press charges because it wasn't really worth the time and the effort. Now, you know what? A person like that needs serious rehabilitation. And I'm going to tell you what. She likes her freedom. If she didn't like her freedom, she wouldn't go around just putting her hands on people anytime she thinks she can do it. And I'm going to tell you another thing. I think by this person being transgender, I thought that made her more of a victim. Now, that's the part that I really don't understand, and that's the part that maybe we need to really just sit back and take a look at. But that's the thing. I think her being transgender made her more of a victim in a sense than it. And I think that they both should go to jail. Thank you.
Both the girls you're talking about.
Right. And I think that they both should go to jail. Thank you. Both the girls you're talking about.
A little feedback there. Keith, thanks for your call.
I mean, that's one of the problems, is that if nothing happened, people learn that you can do bad things and there's no accountability for it.
Right. And so the question is, in situations like this, This is the devil's dilemma in some senses. Maybe it's not, for some people it's not a devil's dilemma. I'm making it a devil's dilemma. Before we go to our next caller, Yvette, and then Ellen, Hank, and Cherie, is that these two girls clearly have histories of violence and been arrested for, at least one of them has been arrested for, a similar kind of assault. People do have to accept, no matter how damaged they are, responsibilities for their actions. And be held accountable for their actions.
Right.
Right? So then the question is, in this kind of instance, is how? I mean, what's the argument that these young women should not be in jail and should instead be allowed to stay outside and become part of a larger therapeutic community that addresses this issue? I mean, it's very hard to swallow for a lot of people to think these two young women who have this history of violence inside of them should be in jail.
I mean, I know that I'm sure a lot of people want to chime in, but I mean, one fundamental thing is that punishment tells us what not to do. It doesn't tell us anything about how to do it differently in the future.
And I totally agree. Punishment is to hurt, whereas in a therapeutic community, if you discipline means to teach. And so what we have to do, yes, she needs to be held accountable for her action, but we shouldn't be punitive in the sense that we're just going to say, okay, throw her to jail. What's rehabilitating in a jail? Many people who enter into that institutional system today, when they leave, they mimic the behavior of the subculture that's there. Usually they tend to get worse. What I mean by systemic approach, not just for the young girl, but community at large of what it is that we're supposed to do. Community conferences, I'm trained in it. It's excellent. It's an excellent intervention that could be used. But what about billboards? What about how we change or filter the information that our young people or families or community as a whole are listening to and they mimic? Why not transcend the appropriate messages, whether it's healthy community, healthier living, healthier communication, healthier interactions, healthier family bonding? Why don't we transcend those type of communication, those images, and that people begin to imitate those things, and then we begin to see a change in this violent behavior that hip-hop music, television shows, some of our households, even the government itself. They all fight in war. And so we have a society that perpetuates this, and you have people assimilating to that culture.
I just wanted to say that I really want to applaud Lauren and this community conferencing approach because, you know, as a member of the board of the Washington Peace Center, we are constantly looking for constructive models of conflict resolution and for dealing with the systemic violence in our society. I agree that these two young women should be held accountable in some form, but I would ask the question, where is the accountability for police officers who repeatedly beat up and abuse African-American folks on the streets of D.C. and Baltimore? It would be a tragedy to me for these young women to be put away for the rest of their lives in some capacity for a crime like this when people in power get away with far worse acts of violence constantly. So I would be in favor of some accountability mechanism for these two young women. But if after a process, these two women who committed this violence would be willing to be spokespeople in communities, in schools for transgender rights, I would be in favor of their being given leniency by the criminal justice system.
The question is, I mean, that's a tough argument, I think, a lot of people, for a lot of people to take, David. I mean, almost kind of quid pro quo there, that politically and individual social responsibility. I mean, we can take responsibility. You can address the kind of larger societal issues of violence and violence by police, violence by our country, the wars that take place, and all the other kind of violence of poverty. But on an immediate level, something has to be dealt with on the violence that people confront every day in these streets. I mean, and the violence that's kind of created.
Well, I agree with you, but I think complicated problems require complicated solutions, you know, and you can start by figuring out what to do with these women who committed this act of crime, but we need to deal with the systemic roots of transphobia, homophobia, and social violence in our society.
Let me, unless anybody wants to respond, let me jump back to the phones and get these listeners in here. People are dying to join this conversation with our three guests at 410-319-8888. And Yvette, you're on the air.
How are you?
Hi, Yvette. Welcome.
Good. Listen, I'm sorry, there's a fire truck going by, but I want to say I agree with a lot of what you're saying. But as a person that works with broken people, I can tell you that, you know, whether I don't think it mattered that this person was transgendered. I think the violence act itself hurt people, and that's what the research says. We have to get to the root of where is their trauma, the perpetrator's trauma? Where did it begin? There has to be a healing for that. And we're cutting the mental health budget. You know, we're just slashing it up, thinking people don't need it. But look at what we're getting. We're getting people, girls, 14, 18 years old, beating up grown women, you know, in a public place, being televised and not caring. You know, that's brazen. And I think it's indicative of a trauma that's occurred to the perpetrators. No, I don't feel sorry for them, and I don't think that they should get a pass, but we got to address all of this, man, without pardoning it. We're saying we think it's important for people to heal, but we're not funding mental health, or we're not getting people the therapy that they need. So I just wanted to say that. So and I think I really want to reiterate, I don't think it mattered she was transgender. Right. I think these girls were just angry. That's all I
want
to say. Thank you.
No, Yvette, you said something very important and about the anger that creates the violence that bubbles up.
Yeah, I if I can chime in, Mark.
Go ahead, Lauren, then Dante is about to say something too. Go ahead, Lauren, then we'll go to Dante.
I mean, we've done so many conferences around bullying and many girl fights that have been going on for months and years sometimes. And when we get everybody together at the same time sitting in that circle, like 9.9 times out of 10, the girls that have caused the harm, that have been doing the bullying, ultimately by the end of that session end up in tears recounting times that they were bullied or traumatized. And I think we need to create spaces for young people and for adults to give voice to those traumas because, as the caller said, they have an impact on how people behave. And the Jerry Springer model of dealing with each other is just not working.
That's a great point.
And so what, when you do the stuff you do, and before we turn to Dante and then back to the phones, Lauren, I mean, how do you know that once somebody in a group session has kind of broken down and talked about the violence that they've experienced, that that has actually translated into some behavioral change?
A couple things. I mean, because when that moment happens, that's when the facilitator asks that person or asks the group, what can you do or what can be done to make this better? And the groups, as a group and individuals, talk about, when this stuff happens in the future, how am I going to deal with this? I mean, we've handled cases in Park Heights where, you know, conflicts that ended up in broken arms between Jewish kids and African-American kids and adults.
Yes.
And profound things happening in that circle where people, when they really connect as human beings, a lot of things shift. And so we have seen the shift not only in how people feel, but in their behavior, because we've seen lower reoffending, but the agreements that people come up with to move forward. I mean, they create a plan for when this happens again, if and when this happens, how they would handle it differently, and then what else they can do to make the situation better. And, I mean, the sky's the limit. People are incredibly compassionate and generous and creative in coming up with new ways to handle things.
I think in a lot of ways this is also difficult for people to this is an important conversation to have in the air about this, because, and I know all of you, fortunately on one level and unfortunately on another level, are on the same page. Unfortunately, because it would be good to have some, and we're getting that from our listeners, but that to explore the idea that there could be an alternative to incarceration, an alternative to how we address the issues that we face, and why it's so difficult to get those ideas inside the conversation.
And the thing is, I think as long as we keep people separate in trying to resolve these things, we're going to guarantee that they keep happening again.
Before we turn to our other two guests here, let me just jump into the phones and get another caller in here before we take a break at 410-319-8888. We're going to go to L. Cherie and Hank, hang on. I asked you to hold on for a minute, Hank, because you were on yesterday, but let me get some of these other callers on here. And L, you're on the air.
Greetings.
First
off, I would like to say that my heart goes out to all of the victims in this situation, because they all are victims in this situation. However, you know, we have to understand that things don't change in America until the political environment is conducive for change. You know, women have been abused for years in America, and to some extent still are. However, the political climate is changing to the point where now women are allowed to have rights and they're not as discriminated against as they were in the past. The same thing with homosexuals. They're now being, you know, allowed the opportunity to marry in some states. The question is, how have we really addressed the issue of race and discrimination in America and violence? You know, America is a violent nation. You know, violence is a part of the social fabric of a nation, and it can't be divorced from it. You know, so you have to ask the question, have we really dealt with this situation? You know, I think back to a situation that occurred in the 60s after Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated in Riceville, Iowa, where a Caucasian teacher in a project called A Class Divided, she decided to take a hands-on approach to this situation of discrimination and violence, and teach her Caucasian students who had very little interaction, if any interaction, with ethnic groups in a sort of exercise on experiment or of empathy. And what her goal was to have them to walk in the shoes of other people who were different. And at the end of 2 days, I mean, these youth went through such a dramatic transformation, and they understood, they learned to empathize. Has America really engaged, has the political environment begin to open up where we can really address these situations? I think that it's great, and I'm definitely an advocate for counseling groups and therapy and community groups, because that is a start. There must be a political agenda to address this, because we are inhabitants of this nation, and if we're to get together and work together as one another, you know, we have to address those issues on a larger scale, and that will trickle down, I believe, into the smaller segments of the society and hopefully bring about some change. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Some thoughts here, then we'll go take a break.
I totally agree with the brother. In that project, The teacher used Caucasian students. They were all Caucasian students. And what she did, how she divided, she used blue-eyed Caucasian students against the brown-eyed Caucasian students. And she worked with one color group for 2 weeks. And then the remaining 2 weeks, she worked with the opposite. And they began to empathize for one another. And then nobody, the entire group, didn't want to be oppressed in any nature. And so I totally agree. And I really feel as though that United States, Or as a larger group, no, we haven't addressed anything. I do believe that some of these things have to be dealt with on a political basis, with bills that's become laws, and then it trickles down. Because what happened is we have to create a momentum, and it can't just be so small in a small location of Rosedale. It has to be a Maryland buzz, and then people at that time will begin to assimilate to what it is that the legislator from those advocacy groups had actually passed down.
I just want to also echo some of that. I want to applaud you, Mark, for creating this space, because while it might be interesting and dramatic to have us argue with someone who just wants to lock someone up and throw away the key, I think we need way, way, way more space in our society for people to talk about constructive and systemic solutions to problems. And I also want to applaud callers, because I wasn't sure what to expect from callers. I wasn't sure if there would be people calling in who had some level of bigotry towards folks who are transgender or folks who are gay. And I think this shows that we have made progress, but I think that we have to remember history. Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist, said that without struggle there is no progress. Mm-hmm. And I think that remains true, because while there have been advances for women's rights, today the right to abortion is under attack for women. Domestic violence is still a huge issue. Rape is a huge issue. Whether rape is an issue. So I think we have to deal with systemic solutions. And the brother spoke about race and discrimination. We live in a country where black exclusion from key segments of the job market remains a major issue, where African-American incarceration is a huge issue, where institutionalized racism is a huge issue. And without dealing with those things, we get nowhere. And if you want to talk about accountability in this situation, what about McDonald's? McDonald's is a corporation that pays people poverty wages and that does nothing to train people to deal with situations like this. And I read on a website that the responsible employees had been fired. Now, okay, that's something, but if someone's going to pay damages to the person who was beaten up, I think it should be the corporation of McDonald's.
All right, well, let's wrestle that when we come back. I'll take a short break. We are here with our three guests. You heard David Thurston, board member of the Washington Peace Center. On the phone, Lauren Abramson, executive director of the Community Conferencing Center here in Baltimore, doing work across the nation and the world. Dante Wilson, director of Reclaiming Our Children and Community Project. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food, design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. When we return, we will go straight to Cherie's call, Hank, Maria, Keisha, and Jackson, all lined up to be part of this conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And we have some emails as well. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're having a conversation here with Lauren Abramson, executive director of the Community Conferencing Center, David Thurston, board member of the Washington Peace Center, Dante Wilson, director of Reclaiming Our Children and Community Project. When we have the kind of violent incidents that we have had in our community, but the conversation emanated from what happened to the transgender woman at McDonald's, being beaten by two young girls, two young women, We're talking about what our response should be. Is there a response other than jailing, or is that the response that we need to have? 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. We had an email, which was really several interesting emails. And I will read them. One by Katie, who wrote at the very top of the hour. Then we're going to go to Cherie, our first caller. She said, "Hey, Mark, what makes me the most angry about this whole thing is the way most of the local media outlets first hyped it as a racial incident only. Mm-hmm. They focused primarily on the fact that it was two black girls attacking a white girl. They got everyone all upset about racism involved and did not acknowledge the true nature of the hate crime until a few days ago. This does nothing to help smoldering tensions and completely ignores the very prevalent and rampant attacks on the transgendered community." That's interesting. I think that there's no question that this woman being transgender had a lot to do with this attack and people's attitudes towards transgender people and the fear and anger it rises in a lot of people who don't understand. And when we start talking about hate crimes, sometimes when we talk about hate crimes, it can often obfuscate and make the issue even murkier. Mm-hmm. Sometimes. I'll just throw that out.
Yeah, I like what the email suggested. I think the media does bear a lot of responsibility. Very often, violence is sensationalized and the violence is not examined and understood because there's not a lot of penetrating analytical thinking going on in the corporate media right. In the United States. I want to come back to the point about accountability that I made before we took a break, because this is a city that I love. I grew up in D.C. and I come here and I see wonderful art and I see wonderful people and I see wonderful energy. But I see a lot of boarded up buildings and I see a lot of people without jobs and I see a lot of people without hope. And it is a tragedy that one of the few entry level jobs you can get in our society is working at a place like McDonald's, which is selling terrible food to people at affordable prices and should be held responsible as an institution for what goes on in its facilities, for how it compensates its employees. I mean, its employees should be trained in dealing with different situations. There's a McDonald's in D.C. on U Street where fights break out all the time because poor folk go in to get some food where they can afford it, and poor folk get drunk and get in fights. Now, where are the conflict resolution people? Where are the people doing drug and alcohol rehabilitation? Instead of that, you have police, and police roll up and arrest people and punish people, and you get a violent solution to violence. And I think we need to find alternatives to violence. At the Peace Center, we talk about the idea of peace and justice. No justice, no peace. And the alternative to violence is not just the absence of violence, it's the presence of justice. And we have to fight for social justice on every level and on every front.
Let me write to the phones. 410-319-8888. Cherie, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hello, Mark.
Hi, Cherie.
Our guest. One of the guests mentioned we need complicated resolutions for complicated issues regarding bigotry, institutionalized racism, et cetera. And I definitely agree with that statement. I think because we live in such a progressive society today, many people, especially the younger generations, I don't want to say they're not really familiar with or used to discrimination or in-your-face racism. But, I mean, just going back to looking at the 60s into the 70s and what most historians would mark or deem as the modern era in American history, when there were, you know, a series of human rights, women's rights revolutions going on around that time, and more progressivism and, liberalist ideals were, you know, infused within the communities. So I think now that we're 40 years post that era, we feel that, everything's a free-for-all, people are free and so free-spirited to do have their sexual preferences and so forth. And so it's kind of surprising to see this kind of discrimination going on, even though, you know, I hear about, you know, this type of discrimination all the time. I mean, there are a lot of people who are still traditionalist, and they feel that a man should be married to a woman, and, you know, children have no place, it should not be raised in a same-sex household, et cetera. So we do live in a time where there are these conflicting views, but yet we still live in such a progressive society where, you know, it's still accepted. So I think that we need a complicated resolution to, and I think community conferencing is a great way to actually appeal to the younger audiences, because I think realistically, you know, the gay population, the gay and lesbian and transgender population has, like, totally, there's been, like, an influx amongst the younger populations, and that's not being addressed. I think in today's society, it's viewed as more of a cultural fad, a phenomenon, if you will. Like, it's cool, you know, to have, you know, your sexual preference of any gender. And the values are really skewed here, and it's a serious issue, because at the same time, parallel to this influx of the gay, our homosexual populations, there's always the influx of, you know, the STD rates. So, you know,
I mean, are you saying that you think that there are, that being gay is a fad and not a reality? Is that what you're trying to say?
No. It's definitely a reality for some people, but I'm saying for most people, I think amongst the younger generations, it's more of a fad. It's more of a cool thing. It's like, oh, we have the option to be with a man or a woman or both. It's pretty egotistical in my opinion. And so I'm thinking, so I just say the influx to me is a fad, and I just, I believe that looking at our history, there, you know, again, and with the discussion being about violence, we look at our history, and, you know, the spirit of revolution is ignited by the spirit of violence. So without revolution, there has to be violence in order for there to be some type of change or platform to address an issue of this manner. Because right now people think it's cool, but yet and still there are still people who are intimidated by this sector of people who are transgendered or et cetera.
Okay. I you said a lot of complex things there, but go ahead.
This is David here. I was one of the two local organizers in D.C. for the National Equality March, which took place 2 years ago. And it was pretty groundbreaking. There were more than 200,000 people who came to the mall, and the call was around full equality for LGBT communities. And that's an acronym that stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. There also are a lot of people, many of whom identify as LGBT, but who also identify as what's called queer, which is a sort of comes out of a different tradition that is simply means not straight, but also is about rejecting different gender norms. Now, sexual and gender norms are a very fluid and historically contingent thing in human society. If you go back historically, there were same-sex relationships in ancient Greece and Rome. Mm-hmm. There were same-sex relationships in lots of pre-capitalist societies. There are some wonderful books on this that demonstrate that human sexuality runs quite a broad gamut. So there are new things happening. It is true that younger people, like when I was in high school in D.C., I went to Woodrow Wilson. There was no one who was out and gay when I was in high school. I graduated in 1996. Today, there are out, gay, or queer, or however they identify young people in high schools. There are transgender people in high schools. Things are changing. But I'll leave it here. I think that I think you make some good points, but I think that the question of how to fight for full equality is a central one, because it's very easy to point the finger at these two young women who carried out this act of violence. I want to know who's responsible for the fact that we still don't have marriage equality at a federal or state level. I want to know why there's not transgender equality in Maryland. There was a bill that was put forward that didn't advance. I think we have to hold people with power more accountable than we hold people without power and without means.
In addition to holding people with power more accountable, I'm looking at some of the work from Daniel Goldman. And when I look at the situation, you know, I don't want to put it in the category of a, forgive me when I say this, a hate crime against transgender. What I saw was crime. Whether it's against transgender, whether it was against another African-American person, whether it was white on white, whatever the situation took place, whatever it could have been, that is the issue here that took place. The issue that people stood around and did nothing except for the one lady towards the end. The fact that somebody recorded, because when we look at violence, we look at it as entertainment. That's why it went on YouTube so fast. That's why it received so many hits. Not hits of people being concerned about what actually took place, but the fact that it took place and we were entertained by looking at it. And so what I see is it's a society that is, according to Daniel Goldman, which is emotional, that is emotional out of control, because you have two types of emotion, where you think rational and when you think irrational. And what we have is that people are thinking irrational in society, period, and many people respond out of impulse. And so when we talk about solutions, I believe some of the solutions have to be geared towards those emotional capacities of individuals, because that's what really caused us to get into trouble that people get into.
Let me reopen the phones here. 410-319-8888. Hank, and then Keisha, a real quick thought. Go ahead, Hank.
On today, Mr. Steiner. Mr. Steiner, remember when we were younger, right, when we showed out in school and our mother or father brought us to school? What did they do? They gave us two or three good ones right in front of everybody in school, right?
My parents never did that, but go ahead.
Well, my mother did. My mother gave me two or three ones right in front of the whole class. And you know what happened, Mr. Steiner? I acted good for about a whole year, maybe a half a year, right? They shouldn't be locked up. Put them in front of the TV, in front of everybody, give them two good bamboos tied up, three good whacks. Anybody who commits a crime under rape, public flogging, right? That'll change it up for these kids, first off, right? Second of all, once again, I tell all of us, right, we live in an age and day now, right, where we see everything. At one point in time, we didn't see everything. We could leave out 10, 20 years ago and not have to worry about talking to anybody at the house unless we stopped at the phone booth. Now everybody has a phone. Right, so everybody sees and communicates everything right then and there. We are born animalistic, right?
Okay, but let me. Because we're running out of time here. I when you said what you said, Dante Wilson, therapist, kind of shook his head a bit. So
I agree with the statement that we are exposed to more things than we were in the past. I disagree with something such as a public flogging, because what people, human dude, you associate that with pain and resistance and rejection. And when you do that, you actually develop the anger, the built-in frustration, where eventually you will explode on someone. And so I don't know how effective that worked with the caller who called in, but in a mainstream society, that will only nurture further barbaric behavior from individuals. And then we will see more situations like this throughout the media.
I think it's most... what would be most meaningful for the transgender woman who is victimized would be to see the perpetrators of an attack on her make amends and make reparations, and to see the corporation that stood by while it happened make amends and make reparations. I think that giving these women an option of doing something constructive for their community that concretely addresses the source of bigotry out of which they acted is much more meaningful than punishing them with incarceration, not to mention punishing them with a barbaric treatment like flogging, which has a sordid history in this country and in this world.
Let's get another caller in here before we have to turn to another subject for a minute before we take a break. And Keisha, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Keisha.
How are you?
I'm well.
I just wanted to say that, first of all, that I'm pro-Vic, and I really feel bad for the young lady who was attacked that way. But I will say this. I'm very in favor of punitive resolve. Reason being, because despite the fact that she was beaten like that, look at the bigger picture. That young lady could have actually been killed as a result of the amount of beating that she was taking there. She was being kicked and stomped and all of that. And although another young lady eventually tried to intervene, but that didn't stop her from having a seizure right there. two young ladies, number one, should suffer the consequences of their actions. And I believe that because we're Americans, a lot of times Americans, you know, we've lived in a violent world for a very long time. We've always been raised up to believe that we can do certain things and get away with certain behaviors and not have to pay consequences. But I think that these two young ladies definitely should be shown the consequences of what they have done. I believe that these two may have suffered some social misguidance. I don't know if it's that they hated this young lady. I'm not sure if that could be considered necessarily a hate crime, because it was also said in the clip at McDonald's that the older one said to the young lady that she said something to her boyfriend. So I'm not so sure if that's totally a hate crime. But we have to do something. We cannot go around and accepting things like that. Because I know if it was me, I would want my day in court. I could not accept someone just saying, okay, just let's get on a round table discussion with these ladies and let's try to find out what happened. We all know what happened. Now what are we going to do about it?
Keisha, thank you so much. A thought found here very quickly.
What are we going to do about it? But incarceration and being punitive, we still haven't done anything about it. Those feelings and everything that you have experienced, everything that you felt, they are still there. They don't go away. And so I agree with different callers and the fact that we do have to come up with some alternative interaction and where we could bring everyone together. And as a collective force, I believe at that time, we could promote change. So imagine having the victim and the perpetrator there, and the perpetrator has developed remorse from these actions. I'm not saying not hold her accountable for her action. Hold her accountable, but if there's a rehabilitative process that we could use to make the bigger picture where people can conform to. And so I think that begins to have a healthier society, because 14 years old, you mimic your environment. You're not at the age where you're thinking abstractly and things of that nature. For the majority of us, we mimic our environment. And so the bigger picture is, how are we going to attack that situation?
And if we actually had to separate, and we do have to separate some people from the society because of their violent behavior, and that's real, we know those people are going to eventually come back to the society from those institutions, then we have to figure a way, especially for those prisoners, those people who are convicted that way and separated from us, those institutions become therapeutic institutions mm-hmm. and not just penal institutions. That's the problem.
Absolutely.
Because there are people in society who have been so deeply damaged that they need help, and it doesn't, and it, it's help is not, and it isn't just an easy process for people to leave that kind of the semblance of violence in their heart. We only have a few minutes left here. I a lot of people are calling in, but we also had another segment here. We want to talk to Pam Block about the Baltimore Urban Debate Leagues and what they've done for this community and the fundraiser they're having. Let's start that now, and we'll let that roll over the next hour. So I want to thank everybody who's called in. I want to thank Dante Wilson and David for being in, David Thurston being in the studio, and Lauren Abramson. Guys, don't go away. And Pam Block, welcome.
Hi,
Pam.
So, how are you, Mark?
I'm well. So give our listeners a sense of the Urban Debate League real fast before you talk about the event.
Okay, I will do that. Thank you very much for having us on. The Baltimore Urban Debate League has been around for 12 years, and unfortunately, I think we're still one of the best-kept secrets in Baltimore City. We work as partners with Baltimore City Schools. We're in 58 schools across the city and serve kids now from elementary all the way through high school, so fourth grade all the way to 12th. And we use debate as a way of keeping kids engaged in learning, excited about coming to school, staying focused on their futures, and going on to college and better things in their futures.
I think we've been talking about violence this entire hour and what we do about addressing violence. And one of the things I think is amazing here about the Baltimore Urban Debate League is that we're talking about the same kids from the same street corners.
Absolutely. I was thinking this is just actually a perfect segue, because debate and opportunities like debate for young people are so critical, and debate in particular breeds open-mindedness and acceptance and is the exact sort of activity we need our young people to be participating in so that we're helping them to become active and contributing citizens who are very positive instead of young people who are afraid and are acting out with violence.
And how many numbers of kids are now in the Urban Debate League?
We reach about 1,000 students a year across 58 schools.
I mean, that's an incredible number. And the work that's been done in these schools and these kids in our zone high schools across
absolutely.
The city.
High schools, middles, and even elementary schools at this point.
And young people end up going to college, becoming debaters, and more, and become really active participants in the society when it's done.
One of the really exciting things that we wanted to talk about today was the fact that we just had an independent study come out that showed an extremely positive correlation between young people who are participating in debate and what happens to them academically and what happens to them in terms of their interest in school. They're coming to school at much higher rates than their peers from the same schools. They're outperforming their peers on all of the state-mandated exams, and they're going to college at much higher rates than the peers from the same schools.
We can't let you go without talking about the event.
Right. We have our big annual event tomorrow night at the University of Baltimore Student Center. It starts at 5:30 and goes till about 8. It's our fundraiser, and it's our opportunity for the community to come meet some of our fabulous students. We'll have many, many students there to greet our guests and talk about what debate has done for them. There'll be a demonstration debate, and the Lieutenant Governor will be there as our keynote speaker, as well as the Chief Academic Officer from the Baltimore City School System, Dr. Brookings Santelises. And the event promises to be extremely powerful, a great way for members of the community to see some of the very positive things that young people are doing in the city rather than all the negative news that we do hear so often.
And for ticket information, how do they do that?
So to buy a ticket, please go to www.budlcelebrates.org.
And we'll also have that on our website, too. You can make the connection at signershow.org. Pam, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good night.
You too, and good luck. It really is an incredible program. And we have to have many more things that address the violence in our midst and allow us to put our kids in other places and let them grow into different human beings. There's no child out here, no matter how violent we seem to see them in our society, that couldn't be a different kind of human being with the right intervention.
Absolutely.
I do believe that. No matter how damaged they are. Gentlemen, thank you so much. It's been great to meet
you,
David Thurston.
Thank you. Great to meet you.
From the Washington Peace Center and my dear friend and brother, Dante Wilson, Director of Reclaiming Our Children and Community Project.
Thank
Always
you, sir.
Good to have you in the studio.
Yes, sir.
See you next month. Maybe before, if we're lucky.
Okay.
Thank you so much. And we're going to take a short break and come back. I'll remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com, or you can go right to our website, steinershow.org, and click on their banner, and all the information is there. When we return, we're going to talk about Get Fit Families, a movement for healthier kids in our community, how to deal with childhood obesity, and the huge town hall meeting we are having this Thursday night to address childhood obesity and the health of our children, food deserts in our community, and how to change health among our kids, which we have to do. So stay with us. We'll be right back.